From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Thousands of people have taken to the streets of Venezuela in 4 days of protests and counter-protests over the closing of TV network Radio Caracas Television. President Chavez decided not to renew the station's TV license over its support for the coup that temporarily removed him from power 5 years ago. We'll host a debate on the issue. Then this week marks the 100th anniversary of the birth of Rachel Carson, the marine biologist and author of Silent Spring. She's credited with helping to launch the modern-day environmental movement. We'll take a look at her life and legacy.
The screening of basic truth is done not to suit any party line, but to accommodate to the short-term gain to serve the gods of profit and production.
And we'll look at Hillary Incorporated, a new expose in The Nation magazine, finds while Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton is publicly trying to win support of unions in her presidential campaign, behind the scenes, she's being advised by a team of strategists closely affiliated with union busters, GOP operatives, and the conservative media. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. At least 25 people have been killed and more than 50 wounded in a suicide bombing in the Iraqi city of Fallujah. 10 police officers are among the dead. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, U.S. and Iraqi forces are continuing a series of raids following the abduction of 5 British contractors. And hundreds of people marched through Sadr City today carrying the coffins of 2 victims of a U.S. airstrike. The victims were said to be an elderly couple who were bombed as they slept on the roof of their home. The Bush administration has announced it expects to maintain a massive troop presence in Iraq as it has in South Korea since the Korean War. The U.S. currently has 30,000 troops in South Korea and a presence dating back more than 50 years. On Wednesday, White House Press Secretary Tony Snow said the U.S. would remain in Iraq as it has in South Korea, what he called, quote, a force of stability. In other Iraq news, at least 3 Iraqi journalists have been killed in the last week. National Iraqi News Agency correspondent Abdulrahman al-Isawi was dragged from his home and shot. Nazar Abdulwahid, a reporter with the Aswat al-Iraq News Agency, was shot outside a hotel. And newspaper editor Mahmoud Hakim Mustafa was shot dead near his home in northern Iraq. Their deaths bring this month's toll for journalists in Iraq to 9, equaling the worst monthly total for journalists of the Iraq War. In Afghanistan, 5 U.S. troops were among 7 killed when their helicopter went down during clashes with Taliban fighters. This is NATO spokesperson Major John Thomas.
Last night, a little after 9 p.m. local time, a Chinook helicopter went down in Helmand province near the Kajaki area. There were 7 people on board. They were all ISAF soldiers. All of them died in the crash.
In Israel and the occupied territories, Israel's dismissed the prospect of a truce with Palestinian militants and continued its bombing attacks on Gaza. On Wednesday, 2 Hamas militants were killed in an Israeli strike. Meanwhile, the Quartet of Middle East Peace Mediators urged support for the ceasefire at a meeting in Berlin. This is UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
Looking ahead, the Quartet discussed the calendar for the coming months to support and encourage progress on the bilateral and regional tracks. The Quartet principals agreed to meet in the region in June with the Israelis and Palestinians to review progress and discuss the way forward. The Quartet also agreed to meet in the region with members of the Arab League to follow up on the Arab Peace Initiative and efforts to advance the regional track.
The appeal came as Israeli forces carried out what's being described as an extrajudicial execution in the middle of a crowded Palestinian street. Witnesses say undercover Israeli troops ambushed an off-duty Palestinian security officer in broad daylight in Ramallah. The officer, Mohammed Abdul Halim, was shot 24 times. He was reportedly carrying a weapon but never attempted to open fire. Palestinian Information Minister Mustafa Barghouti was present on the scene and had shots fired at his vehicle. At the United Nations, the Security Council has voted to establish a special court to prosecute the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. 5 of the 15 Security Council members abstained from the vote. The U.S. backed the measure in a move widely seen as a challenge to Syria. This is U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad.
We've heard many voices warn of the risk to peace and stability in Lebanon. In the days ahead, we urge all parties to act responsibly and abide by their obligations to support Lebanon's sovereignty and political independence.
The court's establishment has highlighted Lebanon's internal divisions. Members of Hariri's coalition have voiced support, while pro-Syrian politicians say it'll be controlled by the White House. Members of the Hezbollah-led opposition coalition have said they back a tribunal, but have warned against imposing it through unilateral action. In a correction to yesterday's headline, a congressional delegation in Lebanon includes West Virginia Democratic Congressmember Nick Ray Hall. A Saudi Arabian prisoner at Guantanamo Bay has been found dead in his cell in what the Pentagon's calling an apparent suicide. The unidentified captive's death comes nearly 1 year after the suicides of 3 other Guantanamo prisoners. Further details have not been released. The American Civil Liberties Union has filed a federal lawsuit against a Boeing company subsidiary for allegedly helping the CIA transport 3 captives to overseas prisons where they were tortured. The suit was filed on behalf of the 3 prisoners. The ACLU says Jepson International Trip Planning has been a main provider of flight and logistical support services for the secret CIA program of jailing and transporting prisoners known as Extraordinary Rendition. Jepson is said to have aided at least 15 aircraft for a total of 70 rendition flights. ACLU Executive Director Anthony Romero said, quote, American corporations should not be profiting from a CIA rendition program that is unlawful and contrary to core American values. Corporations that choose to participate in such activity can and should be held legally accountable, he said. Meanwhile, the ACLU has also brought a new challenge on behalf of the German citizen Khaled al-Masri. Masri was held and tortured for 5 months in a secret CIA jail in Afghanistan after being kidnapped in Macedonia. A lawsuit against the CIA has been dismissed twice on the grounds it could reveal so-called state secrets. The ACLU is now asking the U.S. Supreme Court to review the case. President Bush has asked Congress to double U.S. spending on the global AIDS crisis to $30 billion over 5 years. The president spoke Wednesday from the White House.
This money will be spent wisely through the establishment of partnership compacts with host nations. These compacts would ensure that U.S. funds support programs that have the greatest possible impact and are sustainable for the future. America will work with governments, the private sector, and faith and community-based organizations around the world to meet measurable goals. Support treatment for nearly 2.5 million people, to prevent more than 12 million new infections, and to support care for 12 million people, including more than 5 million orphans and vulnerable children.
While the request drew praise, some advocacy groups offered criticism the U.S. is both underspending and maintaining a misdirected emphasis on abstinence education. The Health Global Access Group says the U.S. would need to spend at least $50 billion to keep a promise for universal access to treatment for HIV victims. The administration is also extending its controversial requirement that 1/3 of HIV prevention spending go to promoting abstinence before marriage. Jody Jacobson of the Center for Health and Gender Equity said, quote, no amount of money will make up for the ideologically driven prevention policies now promoted by the U.S. American food exporters have signed a new round of trade deals with the Cuban government. More than 100 companies in 25 states are taking part in the deal. The sales are allowed under an exception to the U.S. embargo on Cuba. This is James Sumner of the USA Poultry and Egg Export Council.
It's a tremendous relationship that we have. Cuba is a very important market to us. We feel we're doing each other very well. We're helping your consumers and you're helping our industry. And we recognize that when the embargo is lifted, which we hope is very soon, that these purchases will be much greater and help all of our people even more. So you've been a good friend. Thank you for all of your support.
The Justice Department has announced it's expanding its internal investigation to look into whether senior officials hired applicants based on their Republican ties. The new probe will look into hirings in the Civil Rights Division, which oversees voting rights. The news comes as the Los Angeles Times reports a former federal prosecutor could have lost his job because he stood up for voting rights for Native Americans. Republican Tom Heffelfinger resigned last year after 15 years as the U.S. attorney for Minnesota. His name appeared on the list of attorneys in danger of losing their jobs just 3 months after he challenged a state directive that would have barred tribal ID cards as a valid form of voting identification. Native voters in the Minnesota area have turned out in relatively large numbers and are known to generally vote Democratic. In testimony last week, former Justice Department liaison Monica Goodling said Heffelfinger's superiors had criticized him for spending, quote, an excessive amount of time on Native American issues. And finally, a new study shows rulings on asylum cases face wide disparities depending on factors including the location of the court and background of the judges. The study looked at 140,000 rulings on cases involving the 15 countries that have produced the most asylum seekers. In one court in Miami, Colombians had a nearly 9 in 10 chance of winning asylum from one judge, while just a 5% chance from another. Chinese asylum seekers had a 76% success rate in a court in Orlando, while just a 7% chance in Atlanta. Female immigration judges were also found to approve asylum requests at a 44% higher rate than male judges. Georgetown professor and study author Philip Schrag said, quote, "It's very disturbing that these decisions can mean life or death, and they seem to a large extent to be the result of a clerk's random assignment of a case to a particular judge." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. In Venezuela, thousands of people have taken to the streets in 4 days of protests and counter-protests over the closing of TV network Radio Caracas Television, or RCTV. The Venezuelan government decided not to renew RCTV's television license earlier this year. Police, protesters, and government supporters have clashed violently in Caracas since Sunday, and scores of people have been arrested. President Hugo Chavez's decision to close RCTV, Venezuela's oldest private television network, has received international condemnation, including from the European Union, press freedom groups, Chile, and the United States. The Venezuelan government says it canceled RCTV over its support for the coup that briefly overthrew President Chavez 5 years ago. At the time, RCTV and other opposition TV channels openly supported the coup. In a national address on Monday, Chavez defended his decision to close RCTV, denouncing it as, quote, a permanent attack on public morals. He also called news network Global Vision an enemy of the state and criticized its coverage of the protest against RCTV's closure.
What Global Vision did last night was an open and clear indication that they would kill me. Well, people of Global Vision, I'm going to alert you in front of the country on the national chain of radio and television. I recommend that you take a tranquilizer, because if not, I am going to do what is necessary.
On Monday, Venezuela's government announced it was suing Global Vision for allegedly broadcasting material to incite a possible assassination of Chavez. It also accused U.S. news network CNN of linking him to Al-Qaeda. Global Vision and CNN have both denied the claims.
RCTV's general manager, Marcel Granier, has described the closure as abusive and arbitrary. The Venezuelan government refused to renew its license on the grounds it conspired against Chavez during the 2002 coup, including broadcasting footage falsely blaming Chavez supporters for violence, applauding coup leaders as they overthrew the government, and then refusing to report that Chavez had returned to power following mass protests. In a moment, we'll have a debate on this issue. But first, let's turn to an excerpt of a documentary made by two filmmakers who were in Caracas during the 2002 coup. The film is called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised.
One in four Venezuelans carry handguns. and soon some of the Chavez supporters began to shoot back in the direction the sniper fire seemed to be coming from.
La cámara que estaba en este edificio perpendicular a Miraflores.
One of the channels had a camera opposite the palace that captured images of people shooting from the bridge.
Cuando desde el puente disparan. Ahora, no sabemos realmente, presumimos que dispara contra la.
It looks like they're shooting at the opposition march below, but you can see they themselves are ducking.
Esa gente que está en el puente está se está agachando. Se está cubriendo presumiblemente.
They are clearly being shot at, but the shots of them ducking were never shown.
Averiguar qué era lo que estaba pasando, sino que ya a priori condenamos.
The Chavez supporters were blamed. The images were manipulated and shown over and over again to say that Chavez supporters had assassinated innocent marchers.
Había asesinado o era el principal culpable de la masacre de Caracas.
Ahorita presten atención. Mire.
Look at that Chavez supporter. Look at him empty his gun. That Chavez supporter has just fired on the unarmed peaceful protesters below. Peaceful protesters who were totally unarmed.
What the TV stations didn't broadcast was this camera angle, which clearly shows that the streets below were empty. The opposition march had never taken that route. With this manipulation, the deaths could now be blamed on Chavez.
An excerpt of the documentary, The Revolution Will Not Be Televised, by filmmakers Kim Bartley and Nacho Bryan. That clip featured an interview with Andres Izarra, a news manager with RCTV, during the 2002 coup. He later quit the station in protest over its coverage. After break, he will join us in debate with a Wesleyan professor over the closing of RCTV, the Wesleyan professor Francisco Rodriguez, a professor of Latin American Studies in Connecticut. Stay with us.
Mi canto es un canto libre que se quiere regalar.
Mi canto es un canto libre.
A quien le estreche su mano, a quien quiera disparar.
Victor Jara here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Joining us from Caracas, Venezuela, is Andres Izada, who quit RCTV, later served as Venezuela's communications minister under President Chavez, and is now president of Telesur, the multinational satellite network launched by Venezuela, Argentina, Bolivia, and Cuba. And on the phone with us from Connecticut, Francisco Rodriguez, an assistant professor of economics and Latin American studies at Wesleyan University, former chief economist of the Venezuelan National Assembly. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Andres Izada in Venezuela. Why did President Chavez shut down RCTV?
President Chavez hasn't shut down any TV station. The concession has expired after 53 years. And the government decided not to renew the concession because it needed to develop a national public service television. There is no shutdown at all.
And could you talk a little bit about the time that you were news director at RCTV at the time of the coup, and the reason for your initial resignation and your concerns about RCTV's news coverage?
Well, RCTV during the 2002 coup d'etat in Venezuela was a factor aligned with the interest of the dictatorship that was installed in our country for 48 hours. It is no secret, not just with RCTV, but all the other private media, radio and television, were aligned in promoting protests and the whole process that led to the incarceration of President Chavez during this brief period of time, and the censorship that was imposed on all of us journalists during those days in the effort of the private TV and radio stations to legitimize the dictatorship in Venezuela. There was a censorship that was imposed on us in an effort to try to legitimize this dictatorship. We could not broadcast any of the people's reaction to the decree and to the dictator Carmona, and we could not cover anything that was happening in Venezuela because instead of spreading the news of what was going on, the broadcast stations were broadcasting telenovelas, soap operas, and cartoons.
We want to bring in Francisco Rodriguez, assistant professor at Wesleyan University, former chief economist of the Venezuelan National Assembly. Your response to RCTV's closing?
Yes, well, I think that I'm actually quite surprised that Mr. Izada says that RCTV is not being closed down. It's the nation's oldest private TV station. It's been operating since the 50s. It's the nation's most widely viewed TV station. It's very clear that the government is going against it because it doesn't follow the government line. It has very much of a pro-opposition stance. Now, the government, as Mr. Izada said, has charged it with supporting the coup. Now, in a democracy, usually it is not sufficient for somebody to be accused of committing a crime in order for the government to be able to take action against them. In a democracy, when somebody is believed to have conspired against the government, they have the right to defend themselves in court. They're taken to a court of law, and only after a court has said they are guilty is it that the executive power can actually take some measure against them. So effectively, if Mr. Izada or Mr. Chavez have proof that RCTV conspired against the government in the coup, well, why haven't they taken it to court? No Venezuelan court has decided that RCTV has violated any law. And it's actually very striking that Mr. Izada just said that all other private media also were not transmitting the story in a view during the April 2002 coup, were not transmitting the views of the Chavez supporters. Now, that's very interesting, and I think that by and large is true. Now, what's interesting is that some of those media, which Mr. Izada has just said were doing the same thing as RCTV, have just had their concessions renewed. So, for example, Venevisión has just had its concession renewed. Why, if there's no difference between what Venevisión did and what RCTV did, is RCTV's concession revoked and Venevisión's concession renewed? Well, the reason is that Venevisión now has an editorial line which is very favorable to the government. Venezuelans joke at Venevisión calling it Venezolana de Venevisión, which is a play on words that makes its name almost indistinguishable from that of the TV of the government TV station. So effectively, what the government's doing is that it's using licenses and it's using a set of other economic means, such as foreign exchange allocations, blacklisting of government opponents. The government has published a list of 3.5 million people who signed the recall referendum against them, against the government to intimidate them. And it's using all of these means to try to quash out dissent in Venezuela. I think that's what's happening. And basically, I think we're looking at the breakdown of democracy in Venezuela.
Professor Rodriguez, when you mentioned about how democracy functions, my understanding is that in Venezuela, there really is no, and this predates the Chavez government, that there is really no no process by which a television company can appeal the revocation of their license, that basically it is an executive decision of the government whether you have the privilege of holding a license. Very similar to, at least here in the United States, there's an FCC that fines stations quite often and can take away a license for failure to serve in the public interest, although clearly there's a court procedure here in the United States, but that this the Venezuelan legal system does not provide that kind of appeal process for television stations. Is that accurate?
Sure, but there are a set of international agreements also which have been signed by the Venezuelan government, which specify that these mechanisms, such as the renewal of licenses, such as the use of taxation or the allocation of foreign exchange, cannot be used in a way in which they are geared towards trying to change the opinion or the messages that are being transmitted by these TV stations. So they can't be used to interfere with the freedom of speech. So what is effectively and obviously happening here in Venezuela, and it's transparent in the declarations of Mr. Sara and all of the government supporters, is that RCTV is being punished for its editorial line, and there we get into an issue where there's a violation of the freedom of speech, and where effectively the government is using its force not to regulate the broadcasting system, but actually to make it have an opinion and voice opinions which are favorable to it, and that, I think, is where we see the breakdown of democracy occurring.
Mr. Isada, your response to the position of the professor that you're in essence punishing one network, whereas other networks also supposedly participated or supported the coup attempt.
Well, I cannot speak on behalf of Venevisión and what their editorial line is. I can only speak about Telesur, and we have been covering all sides of the events during all these days, even the. Head of now the opposition, which is Globovisión. The head of Globovisión was on our air just yesterday exposing what their views were. I don't know what Venevisión is doing. I cannot speak on their behalf. But I can really say that this is a matter of sovereignty. And this is just an administrative procedure. In the past, we've seen in France, for example, the French government revoked the license for Berlusconi when he was operating Telecinco. And gave it to another operator. Well, the same thing is happening here, just that in this case, we're not renewing a license. There is no political, punishment being imposed on RCTV because of their editorial line. In fact, 78% of the concessions in VHF in Venezuela are in private hands. Most of them aligned with the opposition. 82% of the concessions in the UHF spectrum are also in private hands, also most of them aligned with the opposition. So what we have here, again, is just an administrative procedure that is being used with political purpose to advance another coup d'etat.
Andres,
there's another coup d'etat effort on the way in Venezuela, just like we had in the past. I must remind you, the 64 days of oil sabotage that happened in our country, where the oil elite stopped oil production in Venezuela, supported by this private media. I must remind you that RCTV broadcast during 64 days, thousands and thousands of TV spots, not commercials, only political message, to take out of the government a legitimate and democratically elected government. If you have such an irresponsible operator doing what RCTV has been doing in our country for over 5 years, that license would be revoked immediately. If you have a private media being involved in the coup d'etat, like you had it happening in Venezuela, you would see for sure that channel taken off the air in the United States and its owners being put in jail.
We're talking to Andres Asada. He's in Caracas, Venezuela, our first live national broadcast video and audio directly from Caracas. I apologize a bit for the sound. It sounds like there's a bit of a rainstorm there, but it doesn't look like that, though it looks maybe a little overcast. He is the president of Telesur. We're also joined by Professor Rodriguez from Wesleyan University. Andres Izada, just looking at thestar.com, the latest piece out of Reuters, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez calling opposition news channel Globovision an enemy of the state, saying he would do what's needed to stop it from inciting violence only days after he shut another opposition broadcaster. It quotes Hugo Chavez saying that... going on to say tens of thousands of Venezuelans marched in Caracas in a fourth consecutive day of protests over Chavez's closure of RCTV. State TV showed hundreds of government supporters marching in downtown Caracas celebrating Chavez's decision. Enemies of the homeland, particularly those behind the scenes, I will give you a name, Globovision. Greetings, gentlemen of Globovision. You should watch where you're going, Chavez said in a broadcast all channels had to show. He said, I recommend you take a tranquilizer and get into gear, because if not, I am going to do what is necessary. He accused Globovision of trying to incite his assassination and of misreporting protests over the closure of RCTV that could whip up a situation similar to the coup attempt in 2002. Andres Azara, your response to that Reuters report?
Well, we have seen Globovision inciting the death of the president. I would like to see what would happen if NBC or CBS would broadcast what Globovision shows here, not just openly calling the people to rebel. In this very small opposition protest led by different, especially middle-class and upper-class students from private universities in Caracas and in the east of Caracas, this is the wealthiest part of the city. I would like to see how the FCC response would be for a broadcaster like Globovision that is constantly promoting rebellion and destabilization and has been supporting all anti-democratic processes and pronouncements here in Venezuela. The latest thing we've had is a clear, open call for the assassination of the president during one of their most vitriolic anti-Chavez shows called A Los Ciudadanos.
Professor Rodriguez, I'd like to ask you, looking at it from our perspective here in this country, if some networks here in this country, NBC or ABC, fomented the kind of public opposition that RCTV or Globovision have against the current administration, do you think that the government would be justified in acting against them?
Yeah. Well, I think it's very important to talk about exactly what it is that they're doing. And as I first of all, as I started out saying at the beginning, I think that there has to be a judicial review. There has to be presentation of the proof against these networks that shows that they have indeed fomented opposition. Now, let's talk about, Mr. Asada just mentioned, the openly calling for the overthrow of the government of Globovision during the Los Ciudadanos program. Let's see what they did. Globovision transmitted a set of images from the history of Venezuela and the world, basically, which were, it was indeed a review after more than 50 years of transmitting what RCTV, all of the events that they had been present in. And one of the images, and this was in a set of different historical images that they presented, was an image of the assassination attempt against Pope John Paul II. And according to Minister of Communications William Lara, a group of expert semioticians, I'm not joking, this was as it was reported in the New York Times, a group of expert semioticians working in the Ministry of Communications actually have identified that the transmission of a historical video of the assassination attempt of Pope John Paul II was indeed a call to carry out an assassination attempt against Mr. Thomas. Now, anybody who believes that in a profoundly Catholic country such as Venezuela, you're going to actually incite people to go out and kill Mr. Chavez by presenting an assassination, an image of an assassination attempt against the Pope, is certainly clearly out of their mind. So this is the type of evidence that the government presents against Globovisión, against Radio Caracas, and at the same time, you have a set of other cases where. In the government TV stations, you also routinely have, and the government-owned TV stations, you are completely used to propagate pro-government messages. You turn on the government TV station, you see pro-Chavez slogans being chanted all of the time, not effectively respecting the difference between the fact that this TV station is property of the state and not of the government, but definitely the government feels that it has the right to do that. So essentially, I think that in a concrete answer to your question, I think that if a TV station were to actually call for the overthrow of the government, and you can prove that in court, you would have a very strong case. It turns out that when the government has actually tried to prove these things in court, even the largely favorable Supreme Court actually ended up throwing out the government's case against military commanders.
Let's get a last comment.
For open rebellion. So the government's really had a hard time, and when one sees the type of proof that they're presenting, one is not surprised.
Andre Cesari, your final response.
Oh, yeah, he's absolutely right. It is hard to, in this country, odd things that happen here. What was a clear coup d'etat, everyone recognizes internationally, domestically, everyone knew what happened in 2002. Our courts decided that it was not a coup. It was a power vacuum that was portrayed by military men who had good intentions and were protecting the president. Never a coup d'etat happened in Venezuela. So Mr. Rodriguez is right. We have a very tough problem, very strong problem here with the courts, who have not even recognized that there had been a coup d'etat here in Venezuela. But in terms of Mr. Rodriguez is an economist, so the economists have a very linear way of thinking, you know. If you show the images of Pope John Paul II when he was his assassination attempt, and you put a music saying everything has its end, people go look for the end, and in a context where you are reporting on all this vitriolic chants against the government and calls to rebel against the government and denounce a dictatorship. That simple historic image gets a new context, and the message gets a very clear direction. You people who are broadcasters, who are communications people, know very well how images can be manipulated and can be used to promote a sense and to promote a line of thought and feelings among the people.
Zara, we will have to leave it there. Andres Zara speaking to us live from Caracas, Venezuela, manager at RCTV during the 2002 coup. He quit at the time. Now president of Telesur, the multinational satellite network launched by Venezuela, Argentina, Bolivia, and Cuba. Francisco Rodriguez joining us from Wesleyan, assistant professor of economics and Latin American studies at the Connecticut School. He is former chief economist of the Venezuelan National Assembly. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back from break, we look at Hillary Inc., a new expose in The Nation magazine. Then it's the 100th anniversary of the birth of Rachel Carson. Stay with us.
Me llaman el desaparecido. Cuando llega ya se ha ido. Volando vengo, volando voy. Deprisa, deprisa, rumbo perdido. Cuando me buscan nunca estoy. Cuando me encuentran yo no soy. El que está enfrente porque ya me...
dicen el desaparecido, fantasma que nunca está. Me dicen el desagradecido, pero esa no es la verdad. Yo llevo en el cuerpo un dolor que no me deja respirar. Llevo en el cuerpo una condena que siempre me echa a caminar. Me dicen el desaparecido, que cuando llega ya se ha ido. Volando vengo, volando voy, deprisa, deprisa, rumbo perdido. Me dicen el desaparecido, fantasma que nunca está. Me dicen el desagradecido, pero esa no es la verdad. Yo llevo en el cuerpo.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
In campaign news, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton reached out to members of the Culinary Workers Union on Wednesday during a stop in Las Vegas. The union represents casino and hotel workers. Senator Clinton said it should be easier for unions to organize and that private equity firms should honor union contracts after buyouts. While Clinton is publicly trying to win the support of such unions, behind the scenes she's being advised by a team of strategists closely affiliated with union busters, GOP operatives, conservative media, and other Democratic Party antagonists. This, according to a new expose in The Nation magazine titled Hillary Inc., written by Ari Berman.
Much of Ari Berman's article focuses on Senator Clinton's top strategist, Mark Penn, who heads the public relations firm Burson Marsteller. Among other things, the company helps firms fight unionization efforts. Up until March, the labor section of Burson Marsteller's website read, quote, companies cannot be caught unprepared by organized labor's coordinated campaigns. Mark Penn's list of previous current clients reads like a who's who of corporate America. Juan, maybe you could take it from there.
Texaco, Eli Lilly, Microsoft, Procter & Gamble, Monsanto. To talk more about Hillary Inc., Ari Berman joins us in Washington. He's a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and Puffin Foundation, writing fellow at The Nation Institute. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, give us a rough overview of Hillary Inc.
Sure. Well, I mean, Hillary Inc. is first thing about, you know, the money that she takes. And I say in the piece that, you know, Hillary, compared to her Democratic rivals, is more reliant on corporate money and large donations. But it's also primarily about the people that she chooses to have around her, the people that will run and execute her campaign and have prominent positions in the White House. And these are people with very, very, very significant business ties, some of which are still ongoing. As you mentioned, her chief strategist, Mark Penn, not only is a major pollster, which means he polls for all sorts of industries like the pharmaceutical industry and the oil industry, which don't necessarily see eye to eye with the Democratic Party, but he also is in a very strange position of running a huge, very Republican-friendly PR firm, Burson Marsteller, which puts him at odds with many of Senator Clinton's public statements on organized labor. For example, and then there's also another very big lobbying firm, the Glover Park Group, that's cozied up to Rupert Murdoch and a whole other host of people in the pharmaceutical industry again. And that's all Clintonites, including a number of people that are now essentially running Hillary's campaign, including her spokesman, Howard Wolfson.
Could you talk to us a little bit about the evolution of Mark Penn in terms of his growing influence in national political circles from the early days of the first Clinton presidency?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mark Penn, you know, back in the 70s, you know, his first major client was Ed Koch, you know, the mayor of New York. Then, you know, he became a sort of standard Democratic pollster, and then he went to work in the corporate world, you know, made a lot of money advising people like Eli Lilly, etc. And then Dick Morris brought him into the White House when Clinton was stumbling in the polls in preparation for the 96 election. And it was Morris, before he had, you know, the falling out with Clinton's and, you know, in his publicized, you know, sort of tiffs with the call girl, they brought Penn in. And it was Morris and Penn that coined the strategy of triangulation, which pushed Clinton to the right, you know, co-opted Republican issues like welfare reform and tax cuts, and basically said make the election about school uniforms and V-chips. And then after that, he very aggressively expanded his corporate business while advising Bill. His company was bought in 2001 by a giant group, the WPP group, which owns Burson Marsteller. And in 2005, they made him CEO of Burson Marsteller, which I said is a very unique position for a Democratic pollster to be in. All the while, he became Hillary Clinton's chief advisor. So he's always been balancing the corporate world and the political world, I think, you know, as my article alleges, pretty uneasily. And it's somewhat surprising that Hillary doesn't have any problems with the corporate work he's still doing.
Can you talk about Rupert Murdoch and the Clintons?
Sure. Well, Hillary basically, you know, made a pretty conscious effort after winning in 2000 in New York to try to court Murdoch and defang, you know, his opposition, you know, because the New York Post and everyone else was going after her so hard. Around the same time, a few years later, in 2004, there was this campaign to try to change the way Nielsen would measure TV viewership ratings, and Fox feared that it would cost them a lot of money in advertising revenue. So they turned to the Glover Park Group, this lobbying firm that's very tied to Hillary. And what this advertising firm said is basically they launched this huge campaign under the guise of this minority front coalition, which is a classic strategy that PR firms and lobbying firms use, basically saying this will disenfranchise minority viewers, low-income viewers, which wasn't true, but that was the campaign they ran. And it didn't end up working, but, you know, Murdoch established close ties to the Clintons even more through that firm. And then last July, he held a big fundraiser in News Corp's tower for Senator Clinton. And a number of democratically affiliated News Corp execs have also held fundraisers for her this year.
And the New York Post, clearly a Murdoch publication, has been much more friendly to Hillary Clinton in recent years than it had been in the past, just by observing its day-to-day coverage. But some of the people who were from Glover, the Glover Group, that are part of the Hillary campaign, could you talk about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically what happened is this firm was started in 03 by a lot of very major Clintonites, including Joe Lockhart's Bill, major spokesman, a number of other people. And basically what happens is when you jump off the campaign, you go and work at the Glover Park Group, you essentially cash in. And then a lot of them jump back and now are on the Hillary campaign once again, Howard Wolfson, her spokesman, being the most prominent one, and he's actually the one who secured the contract with Murdoch. You know, Wolfson has taken a leave, but as I said, you know, this firm lobbies Hillary. They would lobby a Hillary White House. They're the go-to firm for a lot of industries. They were the fastest growing private company in Washington in 2005. They've doubled business since the 2006 election. I mean, they're really becoming quite a powerhouse. And there's all these, it's basically all Clintonites. You know, it's the kind of thing where they say business is business, but it's hard to know where business ends and politics begin with them.
Ari Berman, can you talk about Hillary Rodham Clinton and Walmart?
Sure. Well, Hillary was on the board of Walmart for 7 or 8 years, I believe. And, you know, it's something that really didn't get a lot of attention, what she actually did, until two major newspapers, the LA Times and the New York Times, wrote big articles about it. And basically, Hillary was brought on, you know, to diversify the board. She was the only woman on the board at the time. And, it was a tough position for her because there's a lot of people with more seniority, more status. But as these articles allege, she didn't really shake up the system very much. You know, she pushed them to be a little more fair to women in hiring, but she didn't do anything, for example, or didn't try to do anything about, their anti-labor reputation. And indeed, that's not why she was brought on board. And there was an interesting part of the debates in the first Democratic debate. They asked Senator Clinton about Walmart. You know, she said he has a mixed record. And then she went on, very interestingly, to sort of rail against the power of corporate elites and how middle America is invisible to corporate elites. And this is something that Senator Clinton actually does sort of well. But I thought it was sort of ironic, because if she wanted to curtail the power of corporate elites, maybe she should start with the advisors to her own campaign.
Your article also mentions the Entergy Corporation, which runs the Indian Point nuclear power plant, and the relationship of Mark Penn's organization to Entergy. Did you talk about that?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Indian Point is located just outside of New York City. A lot of people want it to be shut down for the obvious safety hazard of having a huge nuclear power plant right outside Manhattan. And it's failed a lot of, safety ratings, and environmentalists have been trying to shut it down for years, in fact. And, this is an example of when Mark Penn's work sort of comes on Hillary's terrain, because Entergy actually hired, which owns Indian Point, actually hired Mark Penn's firm to do a huge ad campaign for them after 9/11, talking about how safe it is. Now the ad campaign centers around how Entergy and Indian Point helps fight global warming because it's nuclear energy. And it won the PR Week's ad campaign of the year a few years ago. And Mark Penn's polling firm polls for the Nuclear Energy Institute. There's a whole lot of overlap there. And one of the main things that they're saying is that now if you close Indian Point, it'll cost, low-income and minority jobs, dirty power plants will go up in, minority areas, sort of the same arguments that Glover Park made on behalf of Murdoch. And I think that scared a lot of lawmakers. And while Elliot Spitzer and a number of Democratic lawmakers have called for Indian Point to shut down, Hillary's called for an independent safety assessment but hasn't called on the plant to be closed.
Finally, Ari Berman, there have been some pieces in Newsday on the close connection between President Clinton, Hillary Rodham Clinton, and Senator Clinton's private jet travel. This piece from the Associated Press, Senator Hillary Clinton saying Wednesday she followed all Senate rules when she accepted rides on a private jet from a longtime benefactor. The benefactor is Vinod Gupta, who was recently sued by his stockholders, his corporation InfoUSA, for his vast support for President Bill Clinton, both in contributions and the Clinton Library, et cetera, and the amount of plane fare that or private jets he's making available to the Clintons now.
Well, yeah, and it's interesting, that the shareholders were saying basically this is too much. It's not worth it. You're spending too much time sort of whining and dining and flying around the country, Bill Clinton. But this is actually indicative of a larger thing that, Bill has made a lot of money since, leaving the presidency, giving speeches to people like Goldman Sachs, big Wall Street firms, and giving them counsel. These are also people that house, Hillary's largest advisors, people like Bob Rubin and Roger Altman. And it's also the people that give the Clintons a lot of money. So there's a lot of ties to Wall Street, a lot of types of business. And this kind of lawsuit is just sort of when you see it spilling onto the front page.
Ari Berman, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank
Ari
you.
Berman is contributing writer for The Nation magazine, a Puffin Foundation writing fellow at The Nation Institute. His piece in the latest issue of The Nation magazine is called Hillary Inc. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we wrap up today's show with one last story. Juan?
Yes. Well, 100 years ago this week, the marine biologist and author Rachel Carson was born. In 1962, she published a groundbreaking work, Silent Spring, that helped launch the environmental movement. It was one of the most controversial books of the 1960s. Her warnings about the dangers of DDT and other chemical pesticides helped launch the environmental movement. At the time, Carson was widely attacked by the chemical industry and much of the press.
Time magazine claimed Carson's research was filled with oversimplifications and downright errors. That was in 1962. Time magazine would later name Rachel Carson one of the 100 most important people of the 20th century, largely because of her book, Silent Spring. She died of cancer at the age of 56 in 1964, just 2 years after the book's publication. In a moment, the ecologist and author Sandra Steingraber will join us from Ithaca, New York. But first, Rachel Carson in her own words.
Is industry becoming a screen through which facts must be filtered so that the hard, uncomfortable truths are kept back and only the harmless morsels are allowed to filter through? I know that many thoughtful scientists are deeply disturbed that their organizations are becoming fronts for industry. More than one scientist has raised the question of whether a spirit of Lysenkoism may be developing in America today. The philosophy that perverted and destroyed the science of genetics in Russia and even infiltrated all of that nation's agricultural sciences. But here, the tailoring, the screening of basic truth, is done not to suit any party line, but to accommodate to the short-term gain, to serve the gods of profit and production.
Rachel Carson, courtesy of the Pacifica Radio Archives. Sandra Steingraber now joins us from Ithaca, New York, internationally recognized expert on the environmental links to cancer and reproductive health, author of a number of books, including Living Downstream, An Ecologist Looks at Cancer and the Environment. In a nutshell, if you could tell us about who Rachel Carson was, where she lived, how she wrote Silent Spring, and the effect that it had.
Well, Rachel Carson was both a wildlife biologist and a writer. She grew up in rural Pennsylvania and was first very much influenced by her own mother. They spent a lot of mother-daughter hours together out in nature. And when she went off to college, she had a big existential decision to make about whether to study biology or English. She decided to study biology because she felt she could learn to be a writer on her own, but she couldn't do biology by herself. She went off to study the ocean at Woods Hole and wrote many lyrical books about the sea, and then became radicalized by the ongoing and reckless use of pesticides as a scientist and a public servant in the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife, where she began to realize there was a disconnect between what scientists knew about the harmful effects of pesticides and what the public was hearing about that. And so she chose to use her life as a writer and as a biologist to build a kind of bridge across that breach and bring out of the soundproof technical literature the evidence, the damning evidence, for the reckless use of pesticides and its effect on human health and the ecosystem. And present that before the public. And she really, in doing this, saw herself in her public writing, in her private writings. She wrote about herself as a kind of prosecuting attorney that was going to make her case before the public, who would be a kind of jury. And so she really did lay before the public the scientific evidence against pesticides. And that happened in 1962. And what the public did not know, nor did her enemies in industry know, was that she was dying of breast cancer while she was doing all this research and writing and going through radiation treatment and chemotherapies and surgeries. And so she died then of breast cancer within 18 months after Silent Spring was published in 1962. Her ongoing work that she wished to get to next would have investigated the interlocking structures between industry and the scientific community in ways that she believed were corrupting science. That is the work that she left undone.
And the impact of her book at the time of its publication on science and on the politics of environmental protection?
Well, her book rocketed to the top of the bestseller list and stayed there for a long time. It's one of the, and it remains one of the best-selling books in science. I think it's rivaled only by its impact maybe with Charles Darwin's Origin of Species, which was published 100 years earlier. And I think it's important to understand, too, the way that environmental activism really opened up a critical space in our culture for Silent Spring to be published. A lot of people credit Rachel Carson with being kind of the mother of environmental activism, if you will, as though she made the scientific case and then the environmental activists took it forward and made the policy changes. But what I argue in a new essay is that there was really a more reciprocal relationship between Carson and environmental activism than we really realize. And indeed, throughout the 1950s, actually at the height of the McCarthy era, there was an environmental grassroots group in Long Island called themselves the Committee Against Mass Poisoning. And they objected to the mass spraying of pesticides by air over residential areas and filed a lawsuit that wended its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. They also organized and wrote letters to the editor.
Sandra,
the result was
seconds.
That the literary community of New York City learned a lot about this, and they offered Rachel Carson the opportunity to publish.
Sandra Steingraber, we want to thank you very much for being with us, ecologist and author, talking about Rachel Carson on this 100th anniversary of her birth. Rachel Carson, author of Silent Spring. That does it for our broadcast, Democracy Now!, produced by Mike Burke, Shufo Dokadoosh, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matei, Jen Yutz, Anjali Kamat, Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira, our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!